Hello and welcome to the Airline Weekly Lounge. I'm your host, Gordon Smith. And this week, I'm joined by co-host Jay Shabbat to discuss the latest developments at JetBlue and Volaris. Hi, Jay. How's it going?
Good, Gordon. How is everything for you this fine April day?
Well, we're recording Wednesday as normal, and we are in the thick of earnings season. We're up to our eyeballs, and we've got lots of other news stories pushing around the skift in airline weekly newsrooms. But yeah, we're doing well. That's what we journalists enjoy. We like a busy news day.
Oh yeah, there's nothing as exciting as earnings season for sure. A whole lot of new information coming in, and yeah, that's what we live for, right, Gordon?
Top three.
We'll spare the audience the other two.
Let's look at JetBlue first of all, Jay, and we're going to come to Volaris in a moment, or rather in part two. Give us your top line take. What do our listeners need to know about JetBlue, an airline that I dare say has not exactly been out of the headlines in the past few months?
Right. It's a very bad situation, that's the headline. The operating margin, which is, if you've been listening to this podcast or been reading Airline Weekly, that'll sound familiar. We look at that a lot, the operating margin. That's how we compare across different airlines. And they were at -7%, excluding some. There's a bunch of special items related to the Spirit merger and whatnot that were taken out there. But -7%, which is pretty rotten. They did -6% last year's first quarter. And just if you want to compare it to the first quarter of 2019, they actually had a positive 5%. So something is rotten in the state of New York, or however you want to describe it.
I'm sure there's a Big Apple analogy we can use.
Yeah. I was trying to think of an Apple. But in any case, yeah, and they're... Wherever they are, it's not a pretty picture. They have, of course, disappointed that the Spirit merger was blocked by the powers that be. And there's a whole bunch of other things going on too, as well as exposure to the Airbus A321neos that they badly need and badly want. They're just not getting them, or the ones that many of those they have are grounded because of this geared turbofan engine issue. So that's one big problem. And another major problem is that their Latin American / Caribbean routes are really under competitive assault. And they didn't get too much in the weeds on exactly where they were having trouble or why that was the case. But after digging through, some of the schedule data, it becomes pretty clear that that Delta is launching an all-out war against them on some of their key routes. And see if I can dig up some numbers for you here. They have, for example, so JFK to San Juan is their busiest Caribbean route, and Delta's capacity on that route is up 12%. And I believe that's just Delta. I have this is for all other airlines. I believe just Delta's on that. We can go down to like JFK Aruba. Other airline capacity is up 22%. I believe that's Delta as well. JFK to Punta Cana up 73%. So they're really having, and that's, I kind of picked the extreme examples there. Not all of their routes are seeing that kind of thing, but they're definitely feeling the capacity pressure on some of these routes where they traditionally, make a good amount of money. And so there you have it. I mean, that's another reason why JetBlue is, really troubled right now.
Some of the other airlines stealing their lunch, as we would say. And yeah, fascinating to hear from Marty St. Yep. George, the relatively new president of JetBlue. Regular listeners might know his name from JetBlue sort of pre-2019, I want to say, Jay. And then he left the company, and then he came back at a couple of months ago now. But yeah, his first sort of full earnings day as president. He said Latin America made up 35% of JetBlue's total capacity, but that industry capacity in the region had increased by 60% since 2019. So a huge amount of pressure on what was traditionally quite a lucrative part of the world. for JetBlue. Jay, what would you say to listeners who are thinking, let's not be too tough on them? Q1's a tough quarter for everyone.
Well, it's Q1 is traditionally a tough quarter, yes, but for an airline like JetBlue, it should be less tough because they have so much exposure to the Caribbean and Florida, and these are markets that are supposed to do well in the first quarter, you know, when everybody's freezing cold up where I live in the New York area, the Philadelphia area. And that's when everybody's going down Boston. That's when everybody's going down to these places. So if you look historically, I don't think that Q1, even for JetBlue, is their best quarter. I mean, for example, like Transcontinental, just completely opposite. Tends to be very bad in Q1, very good in Q3. So, let's not overemphasize it. But they, you know, if anybody's going to, let's put it this way, they shouldn't be losing money in Q1.
Yeah, especially under the sort of wider macroeconomic conditions that we've discussed previously on the podcast, Jay. Let's touch, we mentioned right. the Pratt & Whitney gear turbofan engine issue, which is affecting Spirit and Wizz Air and multiple operators globally. We should emphasize it's not just JetBlue, but they have been particularly hard hit, especially against the backdrop of everything else that's going on in terms of headwinds at the carrier. I think on the earnings call, they said around $200 million would be received from Pratt & Whitney in terms of compensation payment. That's still in the process of being reached, but significant sum and not too different from that we heard from Spirit a week or so ago. Do you think that these compensation payments are going to be enough to make up for the disruption caused?
No, not. I haven't heard anybody that thinks that these will adequately compensate in full. I mean, it's helpful, but what tends to happen is Pratt & Whitney will just give you a credit on future engine payments. So it's it doesn't make up for all that. I mean, think about just all of the hiring that JetBlue had to do to expecting these aircraft to be there, and then they're not there. So suddenly you're overstaffed, and that affects your unit cost. And then the fact that you perhaps scheduled flights, many months in advance, and whoops, well, we can't operate those flights anymore because we don't have the planes. So now you're upsetting customers, and your service takes a hit. So if you add up all the costs, the intangible costs, the second order effects, it's hard to imagine that the compensation would adequately address what the pain that they're really feeling.
Sure. And speaking of costs, JetBlue put a number on some of the retirement of the regional fleet. So anyone that's flown with them before might have been slightly surprised to be on a sort of regional Embraer E190 when they were maybe expecting a larger gauge Airbus aircraft. But there's still a decent number of 190s in the fleet being replaced now by the Airbus A220. JetBlue said that they were able to save $70 million on maintenance costs through the accelerated retirement of the regional fleet, and expect those savings to increase to $100 million by the end of this year. So big money in getting those older aircraft, less efficient aircraft, out of the portfolio, Jay.
Right. And that's long overdue. I mean, those A190s date back to, an order made by David Neeleman very early in the company's history, and probably an airplane that really didn't belong in the JetBlue fleet. I mean, perhaps others have a different view, but I think that was a very poor investment on their part. And, we're just reaching the point now where they're starting to exit the fleet, and the A220 seems to be, much better fit for them. We'll see. Once they're obviously making big changes. I mean, they will eventually get, all the 321 Neos they want. They'll eventually get the E190s out and all the A220s in. They'll eventually, the idea is anyway that they'll, get some rewards from all these capacity cuts they've been doing. I mean, they've been downsizing pretty dramatically at LaGuardia Airport, for example. And, one sort of side benefit of that is you're saving on very expensive real estate costs by, not using as much terminal space, for example, in LaGuardia. So they are making, the new management team making, pretty pretty, I don't know if dramatic is the, quite the right word, but they're making moves that that should have some impact in the future. And, you know, big question is, you know, how long before the ship turns?
On the topic of LaGuardia, Jay, slightly off piste, have you been through the new Terminal B?
Believe it or not, I have not been to the new LaGuardia at all. I've been there in years.
Oh, wow. Okay, never mind the new terminal. Just one that doesn't reach your needs, I guess, if you're living close enough to New York, but not that close enough.
Right, right. Well, Philadelphia is my home airport now. I used to live within walking distance of LaGuardia Airport. That was many years ago, in the very early days of Airline Weekly. But that is, I just haven't had the occasion to fly out of LaGuardia. And probably last time was, I don't know, the late 2010s. I'm not sure.
Did you ever actually walk to the airport for a flight?
I used to take the bus. That's you couldn't quite cross the big highway. But I just, you know, I say that for a fact. It was so close that I could walk. But there was the old Q33 bus from my old neighborhood, Jackson Heights, that took you right there. So it was a matter of minutes.
The only faithful. Jay, let's just touch briefly on JetBlue's European ambitions, because...
And by the way, Gordon, sorry to just one more thought about that, is that neighborhood I just mentioned is just a stone's throw from JetBlue's headquarters. That's in Queens, New York. Yeah, and that's they're over, I believe in, is it Woodside? I'm not sure. Long Island City, I think, is where they are in Queens, New York. And LaGuardia is not too far from there either, a little bit further out east.
Well, you can't get from LaGuardia to Europe, at least not on JetBlue directly, but you can from JFK and from Boston. What do you make of JetBlue's European ambitions? It sounds like the mood music's starting to change, and they've gone into Paris and gone into London, Heathrow, Gatwick, Dublin recently on a seasonal basis, Edinburgh, I think, to join next month. Amsterdam as well, if my memory serves me correctly. But the mood music sounds like JetBlue have pretty much done everything they want to do in Europe, at least for the time being. Is that your impression as well, Jay?
It is, yeah. And if you asked me this question, you know, late 2023, I was under the impression that these European routes are probably pretty decent for JetBlue, because we knew from other airlines that transatlantic markets were just really, really booming, you know, with the dollar being strong. And the economy being strong. Then I saw some load factor numbers that looked really alarming on some of the routes that they fly over to Europe. And that made me kind of think that, maybe this is not as, not as much of a success as I thought. In yesterday's call, they kind of, I think the message was, the premium is doing well. The routes are okay, particularly in summer. As you kind of alluded to, Gordon, they're, messages that, maybe we're going to slow this expansion down. Maybe we're going to make some of these routes seasonal, stop flying them in the winter. I think there already is that some of the new stuff. Is it Edinburgh and Dublin, or is that just seasonal?
Yeah, Edinburgh is certainly seasonal. And I think maybe one of the Dublin routes, I think they've got two Dublin routes, maybe seasonal. Don't quote me on that. But Edinburgh in November is a very different place to Edinburgh in August. Speaking as a Scotsman and as someone who studied there for 4 years,
you would know.
It's a wonderful city all year round, and I would encourage everyone to visit if they've got the means and the will to do so. But you can see why, if you were being a ruthless network planner, that it might lend itself to a seasonal route.
Right, and remember too, I mean, London is very big part of JetBlue's international European network, and I don't know what percentage of ASMs, are probably pretty sizable percentage. And I think London, it's probably, I mean, we know, not even probably, I mean, it's pretty certain that the leisure demand between the US and London, particularly from the US to London, has been very, very strong. But that's also a market with a lot of corporate traffic that maybe, hasn't come back yet, or is not flying JetBlue because, that's so dominated by the BAAA Alliance and the Delta Virgin Alliance. And because it's kind of interesting, because there's also such big business markets, these joint ventures have to provide a lot of frequency for the business traveler, and that creates a lot of capacity. So if you're just competing for the leisure component, as JetBlue is, or, you know, maybe some small business, it makes it a little bit hard. There's probably more capacity in that market than you'd like. And maybe that's an issue for them. So I'm not sure, but yeah, we'll see where it goes. I mean, we've got the upcoming summer peak just around the corner here. It's a little bit late for adding anything new at this stage. I mean, you could, but, you know, some of these flights tend to book quite a few months in advance. But we'll see if they make any moves for next summer. Now, of course, you know, the big cloud hanging over this is, or the big question mark hanging over this is, you know, will they get the Airbus planes to do this? You know, that's, I think they would have loved to have more, you know, LR, the longer range versions, and ultimately the extra long range versions, which open up, you know, a whole new window for them, a whole new set of opportunities over across the pond. So keep an eye on that.
Yeah, absolutely. I wrote a couple of weeks ago now that JetBlue were having to use the non-LR 321 for the Dublin route. So that meant no hot food options for their economy core passengers.
I remember you wrote that, yeah.
The galley simply didn't have space to accommodate all of the hot food options available. Those in their premium cabin and mint were still offered the hot food, and there were still hot drinks and other bits available. But the prospect of even for payments, no hot food on what can be actually an 8-hour flight, depending on the winds and the direction, raised a few eyebrows, let's say. So now
you got to go to Scotland in January, and you're cold and you're hungry.
Well, the cold food options did look pretty good, actually, in their defense. But yeah, certainly. No hot meals, at least. Jay, so much more we could discuss on JetBlue, and I'm sure we will revisit the topic in the not-too-distant future. But let's have a brief pause. We'll be right back in part two, and we'll be discussing all things Volaris. Don't go away. Hello, and welcome back to the Airline Weekly Lounge podcast. I'm your host, Gordon Smith, and I'm joined by co-host Jay Shabbat. We've been discussing all things JetBlue in part one, and now we are going south of the US border to Mexico and talking Volaris, because we've had some interesting numbers out of that airline as well, haven't we, Jay?
Yes, and the first quarter this year happens to have been very good for Volaris. So it's this is the good news part of the podcast. We talked about the JetBlue in a way that perhaps you know, was not very uplifting, but this is a good news story.
Ending on a high.
Yeah, we're going to end on a high. Volaris actually had a 14% operating margin, and that's unusual for them to do so well in the first quarter. Now, their earnings, you know, historically have been kind of yo-yoing up and down, but if just for comparison, in the first quarter of 2023, last year they lost money. They had a negative 4% operating margin. So, you know, what happened? So I think right off the bat, we have to just clarify that this year's first quarter featured Easter, the Easter holiday, which is a very, very big travel period in Mexico. So that helped. Whereas last year it fell in the second quarter. So, you know, keep that in mind. The second quarter this year, you know, might not be as good as it was last year because of that. You know, won't have Easter. So there's the Easter shift issue. But more interestingly, the Mexican market is only has three airlines. So Volaris, just so everybody knows, this is an airline owned by the same investment firm, Indigo Partners, that owns Frontier Airlines in the U.S. and also Wizz Air in Europe. And for that matter, there's another Chilean airline down in South America called JetSmart. They own that as well. But Volaris is an ultra-low-cost carrier. And it competes with really just two other Mexican carriers now. So it's Aeromexico, and we have Viva Aerobus, which is another very similar business model to Volaris, the kind of, you know, ultra low cost type model. It's really just three. There's a new military run airline, which I don't think deserves any of our time. It's a bit of a joke of an airline, but we'll ignore that. But those, so it's a triopoly, essentially, not too different than Brazil, for that matter, which is its own triopoly. So just three airlines for a pretty big country. So that's one reason why the supply side situation there for carrier like Volaris is rather benign these days. The other big supply side fact we have to consider is that all three airlines are facing very serious aircraft shortages. So Volaris is very much a GTF carrier, meaning they fly the Airbus Neos with the Pratt & Whitney geared turbofan engines, which require these inspections that are taking like a year to get done. And there a lot of them are just, I listened to the Pratt & Whitney, their parent company had their earnings call this morning, and they talked about how they have, you know, planes just, they plane just sitting around waiting for maintenance. They don't have, you know, the mechanics and the space in these maintenance facilities to actually get to all these planes. So big shortage of aircraft. Now, Viva has exactly the same problem. They have the GTF-powered Neos as well. And their Aeromexico last quarter had all of these MAX issues. So they have, I believe they have the MAX 9, right, Gordon? I do that off of my head. I believe they have MAX 9s. So they were affected by the grounding, and then they had some delivery delays. So you can see why the yields would be rather high in a situation like that where capacity is so constrained. And the final note I will make about Volaris is that Mexico recently had what they call a Category 2 designation from the US FAA removed. And that basically limited for kind of on safety grounds. The FAA basically audits every country's, their aviation safety protocols and whatever. And if they're not happy, they'll put you in a sort of category this or that. And so they were kind of in a, you know, category that limited Volaris and the Mexican carriers from expanding in the U.S. Well, that's gone now. So if you look at what happened last quarter, I'd remember this in the context of Volaris not having all the planes they wanted to fly. But what they did with their existing fleet is they took their domestic network and downsized it by 27%. That's in AS terms. But then they took their international network, which is mostly the US, and they upsized that by 17%. So you can see a dramatic shift going on within the Volaris network.
Huge shift, Jay. And again, for maybe listeners that aren't quite so familiar with the dynamics and the nuance of the US-Mexico market, how much of this is VFR, visiting friends and relatives, traffic? And how much of this is people, frankly, going down from the US to Mexico for a good time?
Yeah, it's those two things for sure. It's also some business. I mean, you'd be surprised that, there's a lot of business that's outsourced to Mexico now, like U.S. companies. I mean, think of like Detroit's automakers or even the Asian automakers, for that matter, are doing a lot of their business in northern Mexico. So there's a lot of that, too. You know, there's a decent amount of business. For that matter, actually, there's quite a bit of aerospace manufacturing, too, in like a city like Querétaro, for example. So don't underestimate that. But that market is mostly going to go to Aeromexico and maybe the U.S. carriers. So for a carrier like Volaris and Viva Aerobus, it's mostly that first category you mentioned, Gordon, the visiting family relatives. I suspect that the leisure markets, I mean, if you think of, you know, U.S. down to Cancun and Cabo and those places, that I imagine is pretty dominated by the U.S. carriers because it's so U.S. point of sale. So if you're, you know, if you're taking a vacation from New York to Cancun, you're probably going to be flying American or Delta or JetBlue or something like that. So it's a lot of VFR, family visit.
Got to get those loyalty points in. I remember I've only been to Mexico the once, but I flew Aeromexico across the Atlantic from Heathrow to Mexico City. And then we did a bit of touring around and overland, ground transportation, mostly buses. And then we did a couple of internal flights, and one of them was on Interjet. Do you remember them?
I sure do. Yeah, they're no longer with us, but yeah.
No, but I was secretly hoping to get on the Sukhoi Superjet, which they operated for a while. The Russian.
Remember,
aircraft.
I said they were no longer with us. I think that has a connection to what you just said. they foolishly. We talk about David Neeleman perhaps foolishly ordering E190s, but that's on a whole different level of foolishness as Interjet ordering Superjet. You know. SSJ 100s. That was not the best idea in the playbook.
No, but as an airline, I quite liked the brand and I quite liked what they were doing and being relatively new. They were
kind of like a JetBlue sort of, that was sort of their business model in a way.
Yeah, there was definitely a whiff of that. You felt like there were some inspirations being taken from JetBlue and others.
Yeah, a little like upscale leisure kind of thing.
Yeah. And I was very impressed. I was sad to see them go when they left the market. I think it was 2019, 2020. There was a sort of
I don't remember. Did they make it past COVID? I can't remember. I mean, like, were they gone before COVID? I can't remember. We'll have to Google that. But
they quit flying altogether in December 2020, and then bankruptcy, I think, started in 2021, the early part of that, when COVID was still very much a specter hanging over the industry. So, Jay, just looking much more broadly in some closing comments, low cost as a business format, obviously very mature in Europe, very mature in North America. And by North America, I mean mainly the US and Canada. In Mexico, Latin America, even in South America, as we've discussed on the podcast previously, it still feels like there's a lot of low-hanging fruit. And it feels like the likes of Volaris and others are there to pick it.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, I think it's always important to look at each market and its own characteristics, you know, individually. Obviously, with Mexico and Brazil is very much this way, as I mentioned. The fact that you just have three airlines for these very, very big markets, that is going to, you know, lend itself to airlines performing rather well financially. And that's, in fact, the case, despite, we know Gol is in bankruptcy, but that's, you know, another story. That's more about, you know, not being able to pay past dues because of what happened with foreign exchange and whatnot, but a lot of peculiarities with those. But the fact of the matter is that if you just look at the operating results of every Brazilian carrier, and I'd assume every Mexican carrier, we haven't gotten the Viva results yet. Aeromexico doesn't do their results anymore because they're not publicly traded. But I suspect that all of these airlines on an operating level are just doing very well. Whereas in the US, it is a very different story. I mean, you have a lot of these low-cost carriers with such a sizable percentage of their capacity stuck in markets that, like Florida, like Las Vegas, like the Caribbean, that just have been oversaturated with capacity really in the past. Remember that after markets really started reawakening after the Omicron virus in the spring of 2022, it was, you know, everybody was rushing down to Florida and Vegas and Caribbean. And the demand just, you know, pretty much held pretty strong. And for, you know, even today, I mean, I think the demand's pretty decent, but it's, you know, that was where the it was like the sirens were ringing, so everybody just chased the demand and threw a lot of capacity in there. And so we have carriers like JetBlue and Spirit and Frontier just really struggling, and we'll see if they'll be able to get out of that by either, you know, adjusting their capacity, or, you know, perhaps Caribbean, Florida will rationalize. I mean, I think JetBlue said in their call that they expected the Caribbean and Latin to kind of get a little bit better in the second quarter. And it sounds like they're disappointed that it's not. So I think there's maybe a longer time to wait here. We'll see. And finally, last thing I'll say here, sorry to talk on so long, but now Southwest, now that's very much its own animal as well, because it's so giant, so pervasive domestically throughout the US. They had a, you know, very difficult year in 2023. I'm very eager to see how they do. I'm sure by the time Southwest, they do report this week, right? Are they Gordon, I think I don't have the dates in front of me, but I think by the time people listen,
I think they might be next week.
Are they next week? Okay. So whenever they go, we'll get a picture of how they're doing, and then maybe we can perhaps make some broader generalizations about low cost carriers in general. We haven't talked about European low cost carriers or Asian low cost carriers, but I think I'll stop there.
That's for another day. We don't want to treat our listeners too much; they'll be overwhelmed. really appreciate your insights as always, Jay. Awesome to get your thoughts and insights into what is just proving to be a fascinating earnings season. Before we go, a shameless plug for a LinkedIn Live event that I will be co-hosting on May the 2nd at 11 a.m. Eastern. That's 4 p.m. for our British listeners, 5 p.m. for anyone in Central Europe, anyone in India, 8:30. Take your time pick. Wherever you are, we will be there. And that's on May the 2nd, as I say, and we are going to be looking at the opportunities, but also the challenges of long-haul, low-cost airlines. I'll be joined by research analyst Ashab Rizvi. You might remember, if you're a regular listener to the podcast, Ashab and I spoke on the subject a couple of weeks ago. This will be on LinkedIn Live. If you want any further details, if you want to register for the free event, go to my LinkedIn page or Jay's LinkedIn page. That's Gordon Smith, Jay Shabbat, and you'll find the invitation there. You also get the event details on the Skift LinkedIn page. So plenty of options, no excuse to miss that. It would be great to see as many of you as can join. Jay, thank you for joining me. I will let you go pick through further earnings and bits and pieces. Boeing has been reporting as we speak, so I'm going to tap in and see what they had to say. If you've got any comments on the program, if you've got any ideas, suggestions, don't forget you can always contact us via email. My address is GS, that's G for Gordon, S for Smith, at skift.com. Jay can be reached at js@skift.com, that's J for Jay, and S for Shabbat, airlineweekly.com for all of your news between now and next time you hear from us. But my thanks to Jay for joining me this week and wherever you are in the world. Thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next time. Bye-bye.
Thank you for joining us for this week's episode of the Airline Weekly Lounge podcast. Check out airlineweekly.com for a new issue every Monday and updates on the latest airline news throughout the week.